Imagine being told that you won't survive without a new heart, or you won't ever see again without new corneas. Imagine knowing that your entire future depends on somebody else donating those organs, but that the chance of that actually happening is extremely slim. That is the reality for thousands of South Africans who find themselves living suspended lives, waiting for an organ that might never come. Around 4,000 people are on the waiting list at any time. Yet less than 1% of South Africans have registered as potential donors. If it was you or your loved one, wouldn't you do anything you could to change those odds? Welcome to A Gift of Life, a podcast series that examines the subject of organ donation in South Africa and asks what we can do to improve the chance of a second chance for those patients. I'm your host, Pippa Hudson, and over the course of this series, I'll be sharing stories of organ and tissue recipients, donors and their families, as well as the doctors, transplant coordinators and other professionals who help turn one family's tragedy into another family's greatest hope. I hope we'll address many of your questions around organ and tissue donation and perhaps inspire you to sign up as a donor yourself. I think it's about time we put the focus on the people whose story is perhaps the most powerful argument in favor of organ donation, the recipients whose lives are forever changed by this gift of a second chance. I have two of them joining us on the podcast today. Tanya Botma is a little over 5 years post a double lung transplant, the first of its kind to be performed in a state hospital anywhere in Africa. And Tina Beck-Bessinger, well, she is 12 years post-surgery for a heart and bilateral lung transplant. Both of them have a very compelling story to share about how their lives were saved. So Tina, as the one with seniority in the room, then let me start with you.
Not really, but okay. I
know you struggled with heart and breathing issues literally from the day that you were born. Can you just briefly explain to us the nature of the medical challenges you faced?
So I was born with 10 fingers and 10 toes. I was a happy baby. Birth had been a little bit difficult. They had to pull me out with forceps.
Happens to the best of us.
Yeah. I didn't want to go get out of that warm, safe space. And I was a little bit tinge of blue, sort of lips and nails and things. And my heartbeat was irregular and faster than normal. But they attributed that to difficult birth.
Okay.
And yeah, other than that, 10 fingers, 10 toes, perfect baby girl, sent me home. And then stories differ between mum and dad. Dad said it was a checkup. Mum said I had a cold that I wasn't getting over. Either way, they took me to the GP. He listened to my heart, and then he turned me over, and he listened to my heart again, and he kept on turning me over and over and over and listening and listening. Mom said it was like the longest doctor's visit of her life. Sure. And he said, there's something I don't like the sound of. I'd like 14 to see a specialist. So what with that, I went off to Wentworth Hospital, which was sort of the premier cardiac sort of center at the time. They diagnosed me. Mum and Dad wanted a second opinion. I came down to the Red Cross Children's Hospitals here in Cape Town, and they confirmed the diagnosis. I had a missing tricuspid valve, which separates the oxygenated and deoxygenated blood. So that was mixing. So right from birth, I didn't have enough oxygen.
Okay.
I had three holes. I had narrowed arteries between the heart and lungs. Sure. Which then eventually led to pulmonary hypertension, one of the rare diseases of the world, essentially meaning high blood pressure in the lungs. Prognosis for life, they said to my folks, she'll be lucky to reach double digits.
And I know you're never supposed to ask a lady her age, but just remind us how old you are as we speak today.
I'm now in my 40s.
You're in your 40s, okay. So they were wrong on that count, weren't they?
Well, I've always been a bit of a rebel. I don't like a rule.
You saw it as a challenge rather than a limitation, clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
But jokes aside, Tina, I mean, talk to us about what the impact of that diagnosis, what it meant in terms of what your life was like as you grew up as a young child.
You know, I never really understood. I always knew that if I was tired, I had to stop. Mm-hmm. And I always seemed to get so much more tired, so much quicker than everyone else. So right from little, I knew I wasn't the same. And it used to frustrate me endlessly. Mm. And all I wanted to do was be normal. And I loved running around with my friends and playing catches. And I loved it, but I hated it at the same time because I was always the one that got caught first. Mm. And then I was always on for the whole rest of the game because I wasn't fast enough to catch anyone. And then I had to give up. And then people thought I was being a bad sport because I couldn't breathe. And
oy.
Yeah, it was hard. It wasn't But, you know, at the end of the day, that's the only existence that I knew.
Yeah. You were fitted with a pacemaker, which kept you going through, I think, your teen years. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. So I made double digits, sort of foil. And, yeah, it was still the school holidays. I hadn't started Standard 7 yet, and we'd been away on holiday. Mum and I had been grocery shopping while we were at the grocery store. I bumped into tall, dark, handsome, blue-eyed, matric prefect rugby player. All the hormones were just going crazy. And we unpacked the groceries and whatever when we got home. And our mum was having a cup of tea and lying on her bed. And I was telling her about said prefect rugby player. And I've always been a bit dramatic. So I was like, oh, mum, he's so... And I took in this deep breath and I fell to the ground. And mom bursts out laughing like, oh, my gosh, dramatic child. But I didn't get back up. So mum leans over the end of the bed and I'm out cold, turning blue.
Sure.
So what with that? She rushed me to the hospital. They stabilized me. In fact, they pronounced me dead and then mom screamed at him. So they did CPR.
Trauma is clearly inherited.
Fighter. Yes. And then, yeah, they managed to stabilize me, get me to hospital, and that's when I had a pacemaker fitted.
Yeah.
And that kept me lively and strong and bubbly until sort of my mid-20s, and I started putting on weight. And I was like, oh my gosh, varsity, too much chips, cheese sauce, mm-hmm. Oh my word, small diet going. Everything I tried just wasn't shifting that weight. It turned out my heart was in heart failure and I was retaining water.
Okay. At what point did the doctor say to you, you need a transplant?
You know, you've got to be sick enough to go on the list. You've got to lose enough quality of life. And I don't think a lot of people understand that. And, you know, every time I went into the doctor's rooms, because I was having a day out and because they were my friends, I was always happy to see them. So I had to ask to go on the list because I was always this bubbly, full of life person. And I said to my doctor, I said to him, when am I going on the list? And he said, when you lose enough quality of life. And I said, but I'm in bed 18 to 20 hours a day asleep. I'm on oxygen full time. I've shaved off my hair because I don't have the physical strength to brush it.
Sure.
I'm eating soups and overcooked pasta because I don't have energy to chew. How much more quality of life would you like me to lose? And it was then that he was like, oh, okay, no problem.
Sure.
We'll work you up. But yeah, you have to be
your own advocate, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
To a degree. Yeah.
But you know, I'm also that just attests to my acting skills, really, doesn't it? But yeah, you do. You have to be sick enough to be listed.
Yeah. So you were listed and then you waited more than 2 years, didn't you? Tell us about what it was like in that period waiting.
So they said to me, sort of 18 months waiting period. I waited nearly 3 years.
Gosh.
And you get to a point where you start to think to yourself, it's never going to happen. And like, you know, you can't be more than 4 hours away from your transplant center. So going on holiday becomes difficult. I changed my whole diet in preparation I gave up drinking, or anything, like even a glass of champagne, for a celebration or anything like that. It just, your whole life changes because you're waiting for the phone to ring.
The emotional dragging energy of that must be so tough to deal with as well.
You know, when you first listed, you so excited, or at least I was, because yay, I've got an opportunity to have another 10 years or whatever it is. And I was so excited to go onto the list. But as the time drags on and as you get worse and your body starts to fail you, you start to think, oh my gosh, is this ever going to happen? What's the point of life? Why am I even here? All of those sorts of things. And it's a dark place. It's a very dark place. And I mean, I've been in that place where I've been like, okay, you know what? I'm actually just tired now.
Yeah.
I'm tired of fighting to breathe. I'm tired of fighting to be awake. I'm just tired. Take me home. And I'm a Christian. I don't know what everyone else's beliefs are, but I had many heart-to-hearts with who I believe is God. And I said to him, that's it now. I'm giving up. I can't anymore. I can't do it in my own strength. If you don't give me a transplant, take me home now. And 2 weeks later, we got a call.
Take us back to that moment. The phone rings and you get that message you've been waiting for now 3 years.
So I was a great one of making the most while I was still alive. So there was this Halloween party that I was going to go to. And I planned my outfit. I was repurposing my 21st outfit. And I was going as Cruella de Vil. So I'd gone and bought these like little toy Dalmatians. I was busy sewing them onto my 21st outfit. I'd like bought two wigs and sewed them together, the black and the white.
Yeah.
And I had been resting in anticipation for this one night out for probably about 6 weeks.
Mm.
And my mum, it was a beautiful sunny day in Durban, and my mum came into my room and she said, that is it now. You have been in this room for 6 weeks. You need to get out and get some fresh air. And I was like, yeah, but mum, I'm trying to save my energy. She said, I don't care. Come outside. So we went outside. Mum helped me. I still had this nasal cannula in my nose with this 20-meter cord of oxygen all the way through the house.
Gosh.
So with mum's help, she sort of leaning on her and on the oxygen, whatever, we went outside and we were standing just in the garden on the grass. And I remember the sun warming my back and just thinking, oh, wow, so nice. And mum's phone rings. Now, my mum never steps away to answer a call. She always answers the phone in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
This one time, she steps away and I'm like, there is something up. So she comes back and she just looks at me. And you can see her whole face is like excitement. And I'm like, is that the call? She's like, yes. I was like, is it really? She said, yes. So her and I are screaming, jumping up and down, so excited. And then she says, don't get too excited. We've got to go for x-rays to make sure that the lungs are going to fit in your chest cavity.
Okay.
And then you think, oh, wow, that's real. So I shake my head. I'm like, no, okay, cool. Let's just go and do it. So we go for the x-ray, rah, rah, ree. We come home and I decide whatever happens, I'm not going to be upset. So if it's a no, I'm going out partying tonight with my Cruella de Vil outfit. And if it's a yes, then we're going to the hospital. So I decide, okay, either way, I need to shower and wash my hair. Because I also know that, like, hospital, once you've had an operation, you're not showering for, like, 2 weeks.
It's grim, yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. So, with mom's help, we go and get into the shower, whatever, dry my hair, what was left of it. And then I'm like, okay, I'm going to rest now. I'm going to have a sleep. And you're lying on the bed and you're trying to calm yourself down and you're trying to say, like, don't get too excited. It might not fit. Don't get too excited. Like, just calm down. And mum used to often come and lie on the bed with me. So mum comes in and lies down on the bed with me and I think she's coming to have an afternoon snooze. And I open my eyes and she looks me dead in the eye and she says, it's a fit. Like, and for that split second, so many thoughts go through your mind and you're like, it's a fit. Oh, wait, what does that mean? Oh, that means a transplant. Oh, my God, we have to go to the hospital now. So all of a sudden I had the most energy I've ever had in my whole life, like adrenaline or something else.
Yeah.
Quickly got up, got dressed, took the bag that was already packed. You have to have a hospital bag. It's like essential. I got on the phone while mum drove through to the hospital.
Let me pause you there and bring in Tanya at this point, who's been nodding, listening to so many aspects of that story because I know she's recognizing them in her own.
Yes.
And then we're going to come back to the op and the recovery and what happens after that. Tanya, I mean, you were relating to so much of what Tina was saying in her story about what she went through in childhood. Take us back to the start of your journey. Your health struggle started a little bit later on, I think. Am I right?
Mine
that?
Started childhood as well. Birth,
yeah.
4 weeks.
Also birth.
Yeah,
okay.
4 weeks premature. Suffered a number of childhood respiratory problems, including meconium aspiration as a neonate. That was my problem. And then eventually, after multiple severe viral infections, I got chronic lung disease, bronchiolitis obliterans, also very rare. It's not often that you hear about bronchiolitis obliterans. That's my childhood, really.
I mean, you were down to such a small degree of lung capacity left. What did it mean for your ability to live anything like a normal life as a child? Were you able to go to school, to take part in sport, to play with friends?
No. I was never able to take part in sports or activities at school. Panorama Hospital became my second home. My school journey, all I remember is catching up on homework. That was all I was ever doing. I was always going to a friend or phoning a friend for homework. I had a brother, and he would go to school, and I couldn't understand why I could never go to school. I was always stuck at home on oxygen or in hospital. But you know what? Things happen for a reason. And one afternoon in my high school days, I met my husband collecting homework from a friend. So you know what? Things do happen for a reason. And I keep telling myself that was my reason, really.
So literally you're going to pick up homework to catch up on some stuff that you've missed and you bump into Skulk.
Yes, and tall, dark and handsome, standing in the driveway of this friend's house, her cousin actually. And I looked at him, I thought, sure, but he's a nice looking guy. But at this stage, I had a roho. I had a wheezing sound 24/7. Yeah. So I was teased constantly as a child. People would call me Darth Vader. I never thought I'd find a man. I never thought anybody would look my way. I remember telling my psychologist, who would marry me? You know, and that saying, alka portet se dexol. It's so true. Skulk looked past all of that. He looked at me for me. And he's just an amazing man.
I think it's 21 years. Yeah, 21 years. You're still together. And I know, I mean, you also thought that having kids was something that wouldn't be possible in your future. And here we sit and you've got a daughter in high school, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, she's 15 next week, actually. She was 9 when I had my transplant. And she's just grown up into this beautiful young lady. But it was a difficult pregnancy, I'm not going to lie. I was admitted at 26 weeks. I lay in hospital for 7 weeks on oxygen. She was born at 33 weeks. So, yeah, it was a tough pregnancy, but I would do it all over again. I mean, the doctors really pushed me there. They really did push me.
Had they actually said to you, don't have kids, it would be dangerous?
They did. They did.
Okay.
Yes, but then the one doctor said to me, Tans, I'll give you 6 months. Let's see. And if you fall pregnant, we will help you through this. And he did. He was absolutely amazing.
Incredible. So here sits Daniela about to celebrate a birthday. I know, though, it must have been really tough for you as a young mom. I think back to those days myself, the pressure, the sleepless nights, the sheer physical activity of raising a newborn in particular. And that's before they even start toddling around and sticking their fingers into everything and finding ways of endangering their lives all over your house. What was it like for you as a young mom? Because I know you were still struggling to breathe at that point. You'd taken such a beating through pregnancy. It must have felt doubly difficult.
Oh, Papa, it was very difficult. I felt like I wasn't a mother. I felt guilty at times because she didn't ask for this. And I think Skulk there was just absolutely amazing. Him, my parents, my family, his parents, they were always coming down to help. My dad would take her to school. Skulk's mom would come down from Mossel Bay weeks on end to come and help me. My mother's a nursing sister, so she was also always available to help. Skulk would always bring Daniela to the hospital. They actually knew Daniela by name. They would say, hey, Nala, and she'd say, hey. And she'd go and ask them for papers to draw. So hospital was what she knew. She didn't know anything else. And, you know, when you go into hospital, and Tina can relate, it's not 1 or 2 days. You stay for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time. And then you get home and it's not that you can just get up and keep moving. You're still very weak. There's not much you can do. But my mother has always taught me from a little girl, don't let your illness define you as a person. Keep fighting. And that's exactly what I did. I tried to do as much as possible with a little bit of capacity that I had. I really did.
When we're talking about a little bit, just to put it in perspective, you were down to something like 14% lung capacity, weren't you?
I was 14%.
At what point did the doctor say to you, Tanya, we've got to put you on the transplant list?
Daniela, like I said, she was 9. So it was, she was probably about 8 when Dr. Johan Tron actually had the conversation with me in Skolk. I was more in hospital than at home at this point. Yeah. And he said to us, it's not looking good. Our only option is a double lung transplant. And I think, you know, when you're sickly, you learn to cope with what you've got. So you don't actually realize how sick you are because you just cope. And I looked at Skolk and Skolk looked at me and we looked at Johan and we said, really, do I need a double lung transplant? Is this the only way I'm going to survive? And then he told us about Prof. Calogaro and Prof. Tim Pennell and the amazing team at Gerdeskier that had just started transplants. And he immediately phoned Greg. And I saw Greg within a few weeks.
And set the process in motion. Now,
absolutely.
It's one thing to say you need a transplant. We all know there is a waiting list to get lungs. And how long did you have to wait, Tanya?
Well, Pippa, because I was the first double lung transplant patient to be done in a state hospital in Africa, Gerdeskier, I didn't wait long. Okay. I think I started seeing Greg in the July, and then you go for extensive tests before transplants. There, it's not just about having a transplant. You go for so many tests before so. And then it's also rehab before transplant. Rehab, they have to strengthen your impaired lungs. You can't just sit and not do anything. Mm. You have to keep going. You have to keep fit because you lose so much strength while sitting and waiting. So I saw Greg, like I said, the June, July, and then I had all the tests and rehab, and they put me on the list November to make sure that I was a candidate. And I was done the 11th of December, 2017.
Now, let's bring the two of you together here. So you both got to that moment. The call comes saying the organ's here, the op is happening. As you've spoken about, Tanya, there's a huge buildup before then. Mm-hmm. It's not as simple as hop in the car and go.
No.
The experience of the operation itself, it is a huge traumatic operation. In your case, double lung transplant, Tina, in your case, double lungs plus heart, am I correct? That's a massively invasive surgery. It takes a long time to recover from. Tina, I mean, tell us a little bit more about what it was like to wake up from that operation.
So I don't really remember the first few days because they keep you in isolation as well. It's a bit like being in a fish tank. But yeah, I remember the day that I do remember, I like woke up and you see that you're in hospital and you see that you connected up to the machines and I didn't have any oxygen on and I was like, ooh,
what's
maybe
that?
I can breathe now. And I remember taking in this like incredible breath of air and I just breathed it all the way in until it hit the very bottom of my lungs, my new lungs. And it was the most incredible feeling to be able to take a deep breath for it not to hurt, to just be able to breathe, to look at my fingernails and see that they were pink for a change. Bizarre. Awesome, but bizarre.
And for you, Tanya?
Yeah, like Tina says, they keep you in isolation. I woke up 4 days later after my op. And I remember a few things like seeing the machines and realizing I was still alive. Because you don't know, you've only got a 50-50 when you go in. And I just remember the tears pouring down my face and I just immediately thanked the Lord above. I was so grateful that I was still alive. But I didn't experience what Tina experienced. When I woke up, because a lot of people say, oh, could you breathe after you woke up? No, not for me. I was still very short of breath for at least 3-4 months.
Gosh.
And the only reason being, because I'd suffered so much from a childhood, I'd been breathing from my upper respiratory area. I didn't know about a diaphragm. Mm. So I had to be taught to breathe again properly. And that was through rehab. So it took me at least 4 months to actually, I remember walking into Greg's office and saying, why am I still breathing like this? I'm not breathing any easier. And he said, Tanya, you will walk in here one of these days and you'll be breathing fine. So, yeah, that was my experience. And pain, geez, the pain is something you just cannot describe to anybody.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I look at the two of you now and you are here full of life. You are vivacious, you're bubbly. We walked up the stairs to get into the studio today. You've conducted a radio interview without gasping for air at any point. I mean, you are, to all appearances, living normal, healthy, flourishing lives. Tanya, I have sailed against you in two races. I mean, that tells you everything you need to know, that Tanya is able to sit in a small boat and operate it. Tina, I believe you've done a Cape Town cycle tour as well.
I did, yes, 2015.
Okay, so I mean, obviously, physical activity is a very different thing for you now versus what you grew up with.
Absolutely.
Are you one of those rare people who loves exercise because you can do it?
Absolutely.
Rather than because you have to do it like the rest of us?
Absolutely. No. I love it. I absolutely love it. If I can, yes.
Yeah.
But I absolutely love it. I mean, the first time I walked into a gym, I was smiling. I was beaming because I'd never, ever been able to do it. I mean, at 40, that was my double lung transplant was my 40th birthday present.
Yeah.
I mean, that for me was a second lease on life. And walking into a gym was like, sure, my life is starting. Like, I can do this. I always used to watch these mommies, you know, with their gym clothes and go to gym. And I was like, oh, I'm one of them.
And, I mean, speaking of the mommies, what was it like to run alongside the hockey field for the first time watching your daughter play?
Oh, my word, Papa. I think that for me is the greatest gift ever, is standing alongside the Astro, shouting and screaming at Daniela and being proud and smiling because I know where I was pre-transplant and where I am now post-transplant. And I'm actually known as the mom with the big lungs. And I don't mind. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Tina, what I love about your story is the way you've taken your experience and used it to help others who are facing either waiting or going through the op itself. You have become a coach and a pre-surgical coach, haven't you?
Yes, yeah, I have.
So tell us a little bit more about what that entails.
So, you know, so many people get told they need surgery of some kind, but they've been healthy their whole lives. And I think a lot of the fear comes in that you're giving someone else control over your body while you're asleep. Mm. And that's terrifying. So my job is to help you through that and help you give that control so that you can have the best possible outcome. So it's a lot of, you know, you've got to be physically healthy, but you've also got to be mentally healthy going into any kind of surgery so that you can have the best possible outcome. And I attribute a lot of my sort of textbook recovery to the state of my mind. And it really, really helped me.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the recognition of the gift that you both received. I mean, you've described to us how absolutely transformative it was for your lives. Obviously, that came at the cost of somebody else's life who became your donor. I'd like to just ask each of you to tell us a little bit about what goes through your mind when you wake up, you are confronted with this wonderful new reality of your gift of a second chance, and then the realization must dawn that that came at somebody else's expense. Tanya, what was it like? I mean, was there a specific point where that happened, or was it something you'd sort of had to mentally come to grips with while you were preparing for the transplant already?
I think that was very hard for me to grasp, realizing that somebody's going to die to save my life. Very hard. And 5 months prior to my transplant, I lost my brother, who was an organ donor. Mm. And he had a power paragliding accident. And he fell to his death. And unfortunately, he wasn't able to donate organs, but he was able to donate tissue. And he was able to help 26 people.
Gosh.
And I think that's what helped me cope, realizing that somebody that had so much zest for life was able to give somebody else an amazing gift, the best gift ever, life. And I think that's why I could come to grips with my transplant and somebody dying for me. I think, you know, after a year, you're allowed to write a letter to your organ donor family. And it was one of probably the hardest things I've ever had to do. How, like you say, how do you thank someone for losing a loved one so that you can live? It's very difficult. And what got me through that was my brother's death. Because we as a family have experienced both spectrums. You know, organ donation is a gift to one, yet tremendous pain to another. And I think that's what got me through it. And I, in my letter, told them how I exercise, I enjoy life, I enjoy spending time with my beautiful family. And I really do this in honor of my organ donor, my hero. She really is my hero. And I tell everybody I'm standing here today because of this amazing woman.
You don't know who she is. I know you're never allowed to have that immediate contact, but it's wonderful that you were able to express that thanks, even if it had to be in a letter. Yeah. Tina, did you have that opportunity as well?
So my experience was very, very different to Tanya's. I justified it in that the person was going to die anyway. And if they saved my life in the process, thank you. So I didn't ever really dwell on the fact that someone had passed away in order for me to live. And then I made contact with my donor family.
How did you do that?
I went through the correct channels. I went through my coordinator, who contacted their coordinator. There's a whole lot of psychological exercises that need to happen and mental checks and things. But they were keen to get in touch. I had written my letter 6 months after my transplant, but they never received it. So their daughter had saved, she donated everything. She donated her kidneys, her cornea, tissue, everything. So they'd heard from everybody else, but they'd never heard from the heart and lungs, and they never knew what had happened. And so eventually, yeah, they were like keen to hear from me, and we texted for a while, and then eventually we met.
What was that like for you?
I've never been so nervous or anxious or terrified ever in my life, ever. Because how dare I stand here in the place of your child? And am I worthy? That was going through my mind the whole day. How will I ever be worthy of their young 17-year-old daughter's life, who had her whole life ahead of her, who had dreams and ambitions and plans the same way I did? But it was the most incredible, humbling, amazing experience. And we're still in touch, and I'm part of their family, and they are my second set of parents, and they are just the most incredible, credible people. And I thank God every day. So now, my transplant, I went in at 10 o'clock at night and I came out the next morning. So now that day that I went into hospital is my day of mourning. And the day after is my day of celebration for new life.
I know there is an additional element to your story, Tina, in that you are an organ recipient. But you're also a tissue donor, and this absolutely fascinated me when you told me, because you would imagine that somebody who was sick enough to need a transplant could never be considered as a tissue donor. But in fact, you were. Won't you tell us how that was possible?
So as messed up as my heart and lungs were, they managed to salvage valves from my heart, and then those got used. I know the one went into a baby in Pretoria. And it's just so satisfying to know that as broken as I was, I was still of some use, and I could help someone else.
Tanya, did you have any opportunity to communicate with those 26 people who were helped by your brother's donation? Has your family had any contact with them?
No, unfortunately not, no. Yeah. The tissue donor sent a letter of thanks, and they were the ones in the letter saying how many he had helped. But no, we've had no contact.
On an individual basis, okay.
No.
I know both of you, I mean, obviously listening to this, you can hear how profoundly grateful both of you are and how deeply you honor the gift that has been given to you by your donors. It's incredibly moving to listen to you tell your stories. But what I admire so about you is that you have both made it something of a crusade for life, that it's not only going to be your story, because sharing your story is such a powerful way of putting a human face to the concept of organ donation. And you've both become ambassadors for the cause, haven't you? I mean, Tanya, tell us a little bit about what you've done.
Okay, so I do public speaking. I go and talk out there and create awareness around organ and tissue donation, because I think a lot of people don't really understand that organ and tissue go together hand in hand. Everybody just thinks it's organs, but tissue can save up to 50 people. I mean, help 50 people.
Yeah.
You know, you can save up to 7 people by, you know, donating organs. So I try and go and do some public speaking, which I did a few weeks back. And then I try and get in funds for the Groote Schuur Lung Transplant Unit, because I feel that is where my life was saved. And there are so many people waiting on a list and that need funds. And I just feel that I've been given a second lease on life to help others, to give back. And that's all I want to do. I just want to give back. I just want to show people how appreciative I, and I'm speaking on behalf of all recipients, I think we're all grateful for that second lease on life. And then the sailing that we've done together, Pippa.
we use the term sailing very loosely, to be fair.
Absolutely. But it's very daunting getting into that little boat and actually having to do the whole sailing thing. But yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying to do things to create awareness around organ and tissue donation and then funds for the Gerdeske Lung Transplant Unit.
And for the record, the sailing that Tanya's talking about, if you've not heard us discuss it before, is the Little Optimist Race every year, which is a charity fundraiser which requires grown adults to pour themselves into little tiny children's boats and try and get around the waterfront without sinking them. So far, so good. See you there later this year, Tanya. Tina, what about you? I know public speaking has also become something that's become almost second nature to you, hasn't it?
Yeah, in fact, I train it now. So, yeah. And I love it. I told you earlier, I've always been dramatic. I keep saying I was born from stage or whatever, but I love it. But I'm very much an advocate for organ donation. And my way of giving back is not just to tell my story, but to help people through the process, that waiting process, that preparation. And then afterwards as well, because having a transplant is a whole new way of living. There's so much that you can't do, so much you can't eat.
Really?
Yeah, no, it's... It takes a minute.
And the pills. Don't forget the pills.
I've been on pills my whole life. So.
No, I know. Me too. But after transplant, it's a whole lot of new pills. It's like...
And it's five times a day.
Yeah, you have to have it at certain times. Mm-hmm. It's in the morning. Like it's 25 pills in the morning and then it's 25 pills at night just after transplant. Obviously, it gets much better. You know, we're not on so many tablets at night. But in the morning, you've got a stack of pills that you've got to have. And you've got to have it at a certain time.
You must be the orange juice supplier's favorite customer.
Just water. Okay, sorry.
So yes, like Tina said, we're used to pills. I mean, as chronic, we've had chronic lung disease, you're used to pills. But transplant medication is different. The immune suppressants are very much different to a normal tablet. Mm-hmm. It's different. And also, you know, being immune suppressed, you can't really be around a lot of people because you can't get sick.
Yeah.
You know, getting sick can cause acute rejection.
And the side effects of the tablets, things like either too much hair, like I felt like I was a monkey. I was in tears in my cardiologist's office. I had a monobrow, I had a mustache, I had hair on my chest. I was like, I look like a monkey, no one's going to love me.
And I had too little hair. I lost my hair. I still remember contacting Tina and say, did you lose your hair? And Tina was like, no, I didn't. I actually got too much hair. And I'm like, oh, I don't know which is worse. So then we were both crying.
And then plus the chronic shakes as well.
From the tacrolimus.
Yeah.
And the prednisone, the chubbiness.
Yes.
All the cortisone.
It's a lot of getting used to. It's a lot of adjustment.
It is. But at the end of the day, you can breathe.
Exactly. It's all relative.
And you will definitely have those pulls any day. To be able to breathe like we're breathing today.
Absolutely.
Because to not be able to breathe, I think, is one of the worst things ever.
Yeah. So I have to ask, I mean, you've spoken about being always aware of the risk of falling ill and not being in too crowded an environment, for example. COVID must have been a very, very daunting prospect to face. What was that like for you?
Sure. With me having Daniela, we had to take her out of school. For a year and a half, she had to do homeschooling. Checkers, 60 minutes or 60 seconds, they became like my go-to for everything. they were always at my gates. I didn't step out of the house. I remember Skulk getting home from work and having to change in the garage, just changing his clothes and getting to other clothes and then coming into the house, sterilizing. And eventually Daniela just crying and saying, Mommy, I want to go back to school. I want to be amongst my friends. It was very hard for us. And Greg said, Tans, unfortunately, you can only send Daniela back to school after your first vac. So I had to wait. I think we got our vaccinations, a year after COVID?
Okay. So, and you lined up early on as a priority case to get them?
Well, unfortunately, we as immune suppressant patients weren't.
Not?
No.
So you had to wait for your age group
We had to wait for our age groups to come up. Yeah.
And Tina, what was it like for you?
Terrifying. Mm-hmm. Absolutely terrifying. my fiance and I decided to go into lockdown before Ramaphosa addressed the nation. I think he spoke on the Monday night and we'd already gone into lockdown the Sunday morning.
Okay.
So we'd already gone and bought groceries and toilet paper and did all that already.
So you're the ones who took all the toilet paper. Okay.
Now we know.
Now we know.
But yeah, I mean, for me, it was like being in isolation again. It was easy. I'd lived that journey. You know, we were washing our groceries. I lived right from transplants. I've lived with masks and sanitizer in my bag. There was nothing new for me.
Yeah.
In fact, even on my social media, I was doing videos on how to wash your vegetables and your groceries and like how to live in isolation, guys.
I agree.
Yeah. So for me, it wasn't too much of a change because I'd had that 3 months of isolation anyway.
Mm.
But yeah, it was terrifying to. To think that you might get it, and I mean, there were
a lot of transplant patients passed away.
Just really? Yeah, they were dropping left, right, and center. It was quite terrifying, actually. Mm. But yeah, I've had COVID and I've survived it, and here I am living to tell the story again.
Okay, sure. I mean, it puts a whole new perspective on what was inconvenience for some of us was literally potentially life or death for you. It really does change your perspective, doesn't it? Just in closing, when you've both spoken about your sense of gratitude, and I wonder if you feel a sense of responsibility to live your lives a certain way or to look after your bodies.
Very much.
Absolutely.
Does that come with the experience? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and like I said earlier, how do you ever be worthy of someone else's life?
Yeah.
And so you wake up every morning paying off that gratitude, if you will.
Mm.
I don't want to call it a debt, but it is. You live your life so that your donor can live on and the family can be proud and so that other people don't have to travel the same journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I get up every morning and exercise. I was told exercise, keep those lungs fit, keep those lungs healthy. And I do that for my hero, my organ donor. I really do. And every morning when I get up, I thank her. And I thank the Lord and I thank the doctors. And that's why when people invite me to large crowds or if I have to go, I'll wear a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not prepared to put my lungs at risk. So, yes, you have to live your life fully, but you have to be responsible.
I'm going to finish with a question that I've been putting to most of the guests in this podcast, which is around the question of what we do to get more people to register as donors and to have that conversation about knowing that this is my wish, because it does come down to what you discuss with your family, doesn't it?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Tina, I mean, what would you like to say to somebody listening today who perhaps hasn't made up their mind yet or was hesitation?
Wow. We're all going to die one day.
Yeah.
I know we don't like to think about it, but it will happen to each of us. That's just the way of the world. Wouldn't it be awesome if you could live on and be a hero in someone else's life and leave a legacy of massive proportions by being a donor?
Mm. And Tanya, that requires having a conversation, which is not always an easy one to have because nobody likes to talk about the concept of mortality.
No.
But it's an important one to have, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. I think if you can have that conversation with your loved ones, you can give the greatest gift ever, a selfless gift.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Gift of Life. Please check out our website, capetalk.co.za, to follow the series in full and make sure you don't miss an episode. And I'd really like to encourage you to share these episodes with your own family and friends. Help start the conversation about organ donation in your circles of influence. If you'd like to register as a donor, please visit the Organ Donor Foundation on www.odf.org.za. It's a quick, easy, and free process, and it could save 7 lives.